This Marketplace podcast is supported by Ascensus, helping people dream bigger, aim higher, and save more with financial confidence. Unleash the power of your retirement savings plan with innovative technology that makes things easy, top-notch service from experts who care, and flexible solutions that can grow with you. For more than 40 years, Ascensus has been helping savers achieve their goals. We can help you achieve yours, too. Learn more at Ascensus.com. That's ASCENSUS.com.
This is it, everybody. Our May fundraiser ends on Friday, and it's your last chance to help us reach our goal this month. Revenue sources for newsrooms like ours are changing, and donations from you, our Marketplace community of listeners, are more important than ever. So please help us reach our May goal before Memorial Day weekend and fund public service journalism for all. Give now at marketplace.org/donate, and thanks. On the program today, electric vehicles and the repo man. Not in the same story. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday today, the 7th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with you, the consumer, and a nod to the reality that life in this economy is complicated and people have a lot going on. We learned this morning, courtesy of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, that credit card delinquencies are on their way back up from the lows they hit during the pandemic amid all that relief money. And specifically, that the people who are more often late with credit card payments also have either student loans or car loans. The resumption of student loan payments and the challenges that that's posing to those borrowers we have covered on this program. Less so, though, automobile loan borrowers. Cox Automotive, it turns out, reports that about 1.5 million cars are going to be repossessed this year, the most since the before times. And Harley-Davidson, the motorcycle people, blame millions of dollars in credit losses on a shortage of repo agents, the people that lenders hire to come tow your car away when you don't pay. So, Marketplace's Matt Levin did a little ride-along.
Kyle Barnes is showing me how quickly he can tow a car with his repo truck.
This truck's one of the older ones we have, so it doesn't... She don't sound the best. She's getting kind of tired.
We're in a four-acre auto yard at Zane Investigations in Sparks, Nevada, a repo agency just outside Reno. Picture rows and rows of fairly new-looking SUVs and sedans on dusty gravel like some sad car orphanage. They average about 35 repos a day here. That hum is the sound of the tow truck's boom sliding underneath a repoed Hyundai Elantra. The car is off the ground in a matter of seconds.
Now you have to get out of the truck.
You made that look very easy.
Oh yeah, I can do this in my sleep, man.
Barnes has been working as a field agent here for more than 3 years. He says often he'll hook the car and then drive a couple blocks from the borrower's place before he actually gets out to strap the car to the truck.
How many times have they come out with guns?
I'd say probably 4 or 5 times. It used to happen a lot more when I worked nights.
Barnes is 26, married, has a kid. Shockingly, his wife doesn't love the idea of him being a repo man, but he loves it.
I consider myself kind of an adrenaline junkie, you know, and when you get that car and you're taking off and say they come running out of the house, screaming at you, running at you, no matter how long you do it, it gets your heart pumping.
A big part of Barnes' job is the art of de-escalation. When Zane Investigations co-owner Kristen Itherboro interviews potential repo agents, she asks less about how many fights they've won and more about how they keep their cool in dangerous situations. She also asks what's in their closets.
Your clothes, are they all like in order by color? Do you hang your pants or do you fold your pants? You have to be self-disciplined to work here, specifically in the field.
Finding a Marie Kondo type who can drive a tow truck has always been hard. The last couple years, though, they've been extremely tough. Zane Investigations lost half its field staff early in the pandemic, and many of those positions are still open. Itherboro says with bonuses, her top performers can make six figures. Base wages are $40,000 to $50,000, and she's still losing candidates to other industries.
I think at this point, post-COVID, we're competing with anybody that's paying.
After the pandemic hit, several states passed moratoria on repos. Lenders were unusually flexible with late borrowers, and stimulus checks helped cover missed payments. That's all over now, but Ron Brown at the repo agency network Eagle Group 20 says the labor shortage isn't.
A lot of the people who were in the business, a lot of them closed their agencies. A lot of the old professionals, they got old. They quit doing the work. They're retiring.
Brown says the flat fees repo agencies get per car, typically anywhere between $200 and $400, they haven't budged in decades. During the Great Recession, middlemen companies called forwarding agencies began negotiating those fees on behalf of auto lenders and typically only pay for successful repos. Brown says that model invites confrontation.
No metal, no money is what gets people killed. The repossessor doesn't get paid anything unless he recovers the vehicles. He's got to make a living. And so he takes chances and risks and does things that he normally wouldn't do.
Brown says the irony is, with interest rates rising and stimulus savings depleted, the demand for repos is shooting back up.
This is giving me a delay.
Mark Zane is driving me around in Zane Investigation's scanner car, basically a sedan with license plate reading cameras strapped to the hood. Lots of repo agencies have these nowadays. Scanner cars just drive around residential neighborhoods and parking lots, randomly scanning every license plate until... That siren that goes off inside the scanner car, that means a license plate matches a vehicle that needs to be repoed. In this case, a white Kia Soul parked outside a Bank of America.
We still haven't shaken out the pandemic. You know, there were so many lenders that put all of those missed payments on the back end of contracts.
Zane says even if you're not late on your payments, you might feel the shortage of repossessors anyway. A good chunk of used cars come from repos, and banks will charge higher rates on auto loans if they can't get their collateral back. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
On Wall Street on this Tuesday, higher again. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The reality of spending the way the U.S. government spends is that the Treasury Department has to do a lot of borrowing. Borrowing that takes the form of bond sales. Just today, in fact, Treasury started auctioning off $112 billion in new bonds, bills, and notes. The total debt outstanding for this country since the beginning is now nearly $34 trillion. Actually, calculating who owes what to whom gets complicated, but suffice it to say, about a third of the debt held by the public is held by foreign countries, the biggest amount of which is held by Japan, followed by China, which brings us to this. It looks like China is offloading its U.S. treasuries. And if so, is that a problem? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore is on that one.
According to U.S. Treasury data, it looks like China has been ditching U.S. treasuries. Lots of them.
Total Chinese holdings of U.S. treasuries are about $805 billion as of August. And that's the lowest since June 2009.
Win Thin is global head of currency strategy at the bank Brown Brothers Harriman. Why China would be doing this, and even whether it actually is, in fact, doing this, is hotly debated. One theory?
They basically have to sell these treasuries to help support the yuan.
Selling treasuries is a fast way to whip up U.S. dollars, and China will sometimes use extra U.S. dollars to go out into the world and buy up its own currency. This artificially pumps up its value. It's like planting someone at an auction to drive up the prices. That is one idea. Another is that China is ditching treasuries because of trade.
The trade barriers that were created under Trump and now continued under Biden, that's going to explain a large part of the decrease in China purchasing U.S. treasuries.
Kent Smetters is a professor at the Wharton School. With sand in the gears of international trade, China isn't earning as many extra dollars, Smetters says, and therefore isn't storing them as much in treasuries. Finally, argument number three for why China is getting rid of treasuries is that maybe it isn't. It just looks like it. Christopher Vecchio is head of futures and FX for Tasty Live, an options brokerage research group.
China uses offshore custodians to hold some of their U.S. dollar-denominated assets.
He says it could be that China is just hiding its treasuries so people don't poke around in its business. Whatever the explanation, this all raises the question of why exactly do we care how interested foreign countries are in our debt? Jesse Wheeler is senior economist at Morning Consult.
So we care about whether or not foreign governments or entities are buying U.S. treasury because it impacts the cost of borrowing in this country.
Here's how that works. The U.S. government has to borrow a lot of money, and it has to borrow it from somebody somewhere. Kent Smetters at Wharton.
That pool of people is just restricted to U.S. households. Then the government is going to have to pay a higher return on that debt in order to be competitive.
That would push a lot of interest rates higher, including on home loans. So as long as they stay interested in our debt, Japan and China could be saving you money on your mortgage. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
We got data on the U.S. trade deficit this morning. It was bigger in September, a $61.5 billion imbalance between how much we're buying from overseas and what we are selling abroad.
I was not surprised by this release.
That's Katie Russ, professor and chair of the economics department at the University of California, Davis.
It's not surprising to me that the trade deficit might tick up a bit right now, given that our economy seems to be growing rather robustly compared to the rest of the world.
In other words, when this economy is doing well, we want more stuff, so we buy it from overseas and also vice versa.
And then if the rest of the world isn't growing quite as fast, then growth in their demand for our goods and services doesn't quite keep up.
For the year, it should be said, the trade gap is getting smaller year on year again. Has been, actually, since the Fed starting raising rates in March 22.
I would expect that to slow our economy and so to start to slow our imports more than our exports at some point, all else equal.
From her lips to Jay Powell's ears, right? Looking ahead, as we like to do around these parts, new readings on inflation and retail sales coming at us next week. Remember how, as the pandemic really took hold, we all turned hard toward online shopping? Well, that seems to be changing if you judge by where some big box retailers are making investments. A bunch of them are spending big on their actual stores, including Target, JCPenney, and Walmart, which alone has spent $9 billion with a B dollars in the past 2 years, upgrading more than 1,400 stores, some of which are now having their grand reopenings. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab is on that one.
Have you ever had that frustrating thing happen when you're shopping at a store you're familiar with, but it's not a location you know well, so you spend an absurd amount of time looking for something totally mundane, like Q-tips? Katrin Helens, a marketing professor at UNC Chapel Hill, says that's a big box experience that sticks with shoppers.
Oh, God, I need toothpaste. Oh, I'm not going to pick it up at Walmart. It's way too big. Let me sort of quickly go to whatever other type of retailer.
Endless aisles. They're Walmart's strength, but also its weakness.
And that's where you see all these investment in the frictionless part.
Frictionless item hunting, with a store app that tells you what aisle a product is in. Frictionless pricing, with digital shelf labels. Frictionless pickup orders, with dedicated parking spots, drive-up lanes, and counters. David Bosick, who leads the retail practice at Alex Partners, says this tech-driven customer service is no longer novel.
Consumer expectations just keep growing, which is the challenge retailers face.
He says people increasingly want to shop in person again, but they've gotten used to the efficiency of shopping online, so they're less patient than ever. Thomas McMillan, who directs the Center for Retailing Studies at Texas A&M, says brands need to get ahead of customers' frustrations.
There's so much change going on. I think that if retailers don't start making these changes, they are going to be left behind.
He says even the biggest stores typically need some kind of refresh every 5 to 7 years. And now, when consumers' wallets are pinched, is the best time.
There's a common phrase that you should be investing at a time when, you know, there's recessions or when there's a drop.
It's unclear if there will be a recession, but if there is, the stores that have invested in the future will be better positioned when people are ready to come in and spend. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
You know what else is frictionless? Our podcast, Should You Miss Something on the Air. It is available to you at marketplace.org or, of course, on the platform of your choice. Coming up, one take on a road trip.
I mean, I made it from point A to point B in one piece, so that's really all I could ask for.
I suppose. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 56 points today, almost 0.2%, 34,152. The NASDAQ picked up 121 points, 0.9%, landed at 13,639. The S&P 500 grew 12 points, nearly 0.3% on that particular index, finished at 43.78. RE/MAX slumped 8.5% today after a downgrade from Morgan Stanley, which said the brokerage could face a greater risk of litigation and costly settlements. Checking in on some home builders, D.R. Horton piled up 2.9% today on better-than-expected Q4 earnings. Toll Brothers picked up almost 0.2%. Still with the real estate latest housing sentiment survey from government-backed mortgage provider Fannie Mae shows pessimism on the housing front. In October, 85% of respondents said now is a bad time to buy a home because of high prices and mortgage rates. Show me the lie. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.56%. You're listening to Marketplace.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We spent no small amount of time on this program last week talking about financial conditions in this economy. The general vibe, for want of a better word, people are getting from various parts of our financial plumbing. Interest rates, bond yields and spreads, value of the dollar, stock markets and where they are. Corporate earnings factor in there as well, and that's part of what's been driving equities higher the past week or so after the Dow and the S&P went all jittery midsummer, spending a good part of the last 3 months falling. We're now about 80-ish percent done with companies in the S&P 500 reporting their fiscal third quarters, and the headwinds with which we're all familiar amid them, corporate America is doing all right. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that one.
4 weeks ago to the day, I did our story kicking off earnings season. And Quincy Crosby at LPL Financial predicted a turnaround after a couple years of mediocrity.
The worst of the earnings recession is coming to a close.
When I talked to her today, she was even more upbeat.
Overall earnings surprises for this earnings season has actually been a solid 7.5%.
Above what folks were predicting.
As far as our report card goes, third quarter will be the first time that sales and earnings grow in almost 2 years.
That's Samir Samana at the Wells Fargo Investment Institute.
In some ways, we are kind of maybe possibly coming out of what's been termed the earnings recession.
Kind of maybe possibly. Because while earnings are pretty strong for the third quarter, a lot of companies are warning of lower earnings to come. One worry is that retailers and major brands that have been riding high could be in for tougher times as consumers deal with dwindling savings and higher interest rates. So Eric Friedman at U.S. Bank says he's listening closely to company earnings calls.
CFOs are deciding, do we want to have more products out for sale, or do we actually think the consumer will actually not spend as much?
Economist Jay Hatfield at Infrastructure Capital Advisors also predicted an upbeat earnings season. And while he says stocks are now responding,
risk in the market has gone up. The overhang from the Middle East and persistently high interest rates are likely to keep irrational exuberance under control.
Meanwhile, a government shutdown could be looming at the end of next week, which Quincy Crosby at LPL Financial says could take the focus off corporate earnings, though.
There's an old saying in the market, it doesn't matter till it matters. Sometimes we have to just wait till that very last minute for the dynamics in Washington to unfold.
She says, give it a week, then maybe start to worry. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Electric vehicle sales in this economy are kind of in the chicken and egg phase. Do you buy an EV and count on the charging infrastructure getting built out, or do you wait for the public chargers to be there before you buy? And that is showing up in sales data. Kelley Blue Book reports EV sales in the third quarter were indeed up 50%, but that was well below expectations. And to boot, EVs are still only about 8% of all cars sold. And where you live and drive definitely affects how you are going to feel about this. Adam Mahoney took a road trip through the South in an EV a couple of weeks ago, and he wrote about it for Capital B News. So we got him on the phone to talk things over. Welcome to the program.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
First of all, I guess, why did you decide to take this trip?
Yeah, I mean, it was not necessarily by design. The rental car place I was renting from in Charlotte actually ran out of gas-powered cars, and I needed to do a drive to Florida. And they only had EVs, so I just went for it.
In a nutshell, how did it go?
It was definitely an experience. I mean, I made it from point A to point B in one piece, so that's really all I could ask for. I did have a few different, you know, interesting interactions with folks along the way, and I wasn't necessarily as versed in just the long distance aspect of EV travel with public charging and things like that. So it ended up taking that initial trip from, you know, being a 5-hour drive to almost 12 hours because of the issues with public charging. But after that, for the rest of the week, it was actually pretty smooth sailing.
Well, that's good to hear, the rest of the week part. But let's talk about the whole public charging thing, because one of the things with EVs, and you point this out in the piece, is that you have to plot your route so that you can stop and charge the car and find the right level charger and all of that. And I guess my question is, even though you were traveling through the part of the country where a whole bunch of EVs are made, there's not a lot of public charging infrastructure.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, in the southeast part of the country, that's where roughly like 40% of EV investments have been made over the last couple of years. So, you know, that's where a lot of that build out is taking place, but that public infrastructure is not there. So basically what I didn't know is that, you know, there's a lot of different maps that, you know, will help you map out that trip, right? And that map where chargers are. But just throughout that region, you know, free public chargers are lacking, which then requires you to kind of, you know, sit and wait for hours at a time once you do actually find one.
Right. And it increases the tension, right? I mean, you know, if you're getting down there on 15% of your EV battery, you're looking around pretty good for a place to charge a car.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, because not as many folks are driving EVs in that part of the country, you know, you might also pull up to a public charger and they'll be gas-powered cars parked in the parking spaces just because folks aren't expecting, you know, people to be using that infrastructure.
Well, so look, let me get to the whole, a lot of folks in that part of the country aren't driving EVs. You talk about this in the piece, and it's one of the reasons we wanted to talk to you. How many young black people did you see, or even middle-aged black people, did you see when you were stopped to charge? My guess is not that many.
Yeah, you're exactly right there. So I stopped to charge in different cities in South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida. And I didn't see another black person until Orlando, you know, so it did put me in, you know, as a young black person, put me in a couple of precarious situations. Like I wrote in the piece, the first place I charged in a small town in South Carolina, I counted multiple Confederate flags. I mean, I was just, you know, I had to sit in my car in an uncomfortable situation for multiple hours while I was waiting for that public charger to get me to at least a place where I could go then find a paid charger somewhere else.
Do you know off the top of your head what the percentage of black ownership of EVs is in this economy?
Yeah, I think it's about 2% as of the last estimates.
Right. So not surprising that even in that part of the country, you didn't see that many people driving a car who looked like you.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it doesn't necessarily make as much sense economically right now to own an electric car in that part of the country, just because one, as we know, EVs that out of lot price is a little bit higher than gas powered cars. The infrastructure isn't there. And gas is just a lot cheaper in that part of the country than, you know, on the West Coast where EVs are really taking off right now.
Yeah. Adam Mahoney, he's a climate reporter at Capital B News. Adam, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time, and I enjoyed the piece.
Yeah, appreciate you having me.
This final note on the way out today, for which I suppose we and democracy should be grateful. Reuters had the story that Facebook is not going to let political advertisers on that platform use its new artificial intelligence tools. Even so, be on your toes out there. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. It's one more for the financial conditions are easing up file. Don't look now, but both crude oil benchmarks, Brent and West Texas, down about 4% today. Our digital and on-demand team includes Kerry Barber, Dylan Mietinen, Jenna Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the executive director of that part of the Marketplace Global Empire. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey, everyone. It's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.